products and natural or liquefied gas. On the other end, nearly three-quarters of Iran's EAEU imports have come from Russia, under 20% from Kazakhstan, and 5% from Armenia. To take the next step, the Iranian government has announced that it's planning to reach $48 billion in non-oil exports to 15 neighboring countries, including Armenia, Kazakhstan, and Russia, in the near term.
In general, we need to increase our non-oil exports to $200 billion annually. This should be a short-term or at least a medium-term plan for us. We must not leave it to the long term. Achieving this target would turn us into a developed nation. All the economic fluctuations we're experiencing are because we lack sufficient exports and income. We need to start moving toward that goal. To that aim, it's essential that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs changes its approach and sets quantifiable goals and holds our embassies accountable so we hit the target. And they must take measures to solve the problems and take effective steps to facilitate them.
The Iranian ambassador to Russia, Kazem Jalali, has praised the level of ties between Iran and the EAEU, pointing out Iran's efforts in the field of logistics and the fact that Iran can facilitate Eurasian trade through regional corridors. Jalali was referring to a couple of rail and sea routes and noted two very important border points of the Rasht Astara and Chabahar Zahedan railways are currently being completed.
In almost all important economic or cultural meetings in the world, the Islamic Republic of Iran is on agenda. It's possible that Russia, Eurasian countries, or those in ASEAN would give up some of their own economic interests to get closer to and do business with the Islamic Republic. There have been many examples that this did happen. There are many banks in China, Russia, and other Asian countries that are doing business with Iran, despite all the economic sanctions in place against Tehran. This shows that the Islamic Republic is important to them and that they choose to pay the price of getting closer to Iran.
Indeed, Iran's prime geostrategic position makes it a key node along the Eurasian transport corridors. For example, Russia and India have both been working on the infrastructure project of the International North-South Transportation Corridor, INSTC, which is now starting to become operational. The multimodal route allows transport of goods from India to Iran's Chabahar port by sea, then by rail across Iran with connections east to Afghanistan and west to Turkey. Further north, it reaches the Iranian Anzali-Caspian Sea port and free trade zone just north of Tehran. As such, Iran can become an ideal partner in unblocking its own connecting corridors while developing new transport and energy routes in the South Caucasus.
Another very important feature of the Eurasian Economic Union, which creates a tremendous opportunity for not only the Islamic Republic, but all member states, which is also present in the Security, Military and Cultural Shanghai Cooperation Organization, is the issue of transportation. Today, the international system prioritizes transit diplomacy. The most urgent issue in economic pacts is transit. Currently, the countries that are opposing the U.S. are looking for alternatives to replace transit routes, one of the most promising of which is a north-south corridor that passes through the territory of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
As far as the EAEU interests are concerned, analysts report that in addition to economic and security opportunities, Iran represents serious potentials for the Union's expansion. On the one hand, Iran will be the first non-Soviet country in the group, paving the way for other nations' membership. On the other hand, gaining access to warm waters on the Iranian shores of the Persian Gulf provides a significant geopolitical opening for the Eurasian Economic Union's member states. That's all for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Was a key figure in recasting U.S. imperial logic towards a renewed commitment to global domination, and all its terrorizing consequences will remain his lasting legacy, says Hamid Debashi, writer, in an article published under the heading Colin Powell, A Terrorizing Legacy of Global Domination. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Single name can mean radically opposite things to different people. Consider Colin Powell, who passed away from COVID-19 complications at the age of 84 recently. As Americans go through the familiar ritual of remembering the legacy of Powell, who served his country in a variety of senior capacities, the rest of the world, and Iraqis in particular, may experience post-traumatic stress when they hear Powell's name. Powell was a hero to his compatriots, and yet alongside other key figures in the George W. Bush administration, he was a solid source of unmitigated catastrophes for many people around the world, especially for Iraqis. The real biography of Powell will be written by Iraqis in Arabic. His name also signals a dramatic twist in the annals of U.S. imperial ideology, when naked military aggression and systematic global intervention in other countries' national sovereignty became particularly acute in our contemporary history. In a study by the Washington-based Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft concluded, there is, of course, no state on this planet more interventionist than the U.S. itself. For us to avoid a chicken or egg paradox of infinite regress between instability and interventionism, we must step back for a moment and place these post-colonial states in their colonial context. Particularly with regards to U.S. imperial ideologies during the Reagan and both Bush administrations, in which Powell was a key military and diplomatic figure. Powell was the first black U.S. Secretary of State who served in multiple capacities in Republican administrations. As both a military man and a top diplomat, he was definitive to U.S. foreign policy over the last half a century, in which U.S. imperial interests around the globe became the dominant ideology of the post-Second World War global politics. Powell served in Vietnam, and on his second tour, he served with same unit that carried out the notorious My Lai massacre in 1968. Although Powell later stated he arrived for the massacre took place, after complaints from a serving soldier about the massacre, Powell was assigned to investigate it and claimed he was unable to uncover widespread unnecessary killings, war crimes, or any facts related to My Lai. This act of whitewashing served him well. Powell's career advanced along with that of U.S. imperialism as the use of force on the global stage in the interests of a state became the paramount ideology in American militarism. As 12th chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he oversaw the invasion of Panama in 1989 and Operation Desert Storm, the first U.S. Persian Gulf war against Saddam Hussein following his invasion of Kuwait in 1990. It was during his tenure that he developed what became known as the Powell Doctrine, a major component of which was the use of overwhelming military force. As a former U.S. general, after retiring from military, he brought the military logic of conquest to the diplomatic apparatus of his country. The Iraqis became the primary target of that ideology. Powell's infamous speech at the UN in February 2003, in which he falsely argued that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction, WMD, not only paved the way for the calamitous U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, it articulated the reason of a state for U.S. military intervention anywhere on the planet to preserve its imperial domination. To be sure, the U.S. was not exactly isolationist before this speech, but Powell's speech was a defining moment in the post-Vietnam War era, recasting the U.S. military logic of global domination. This logic did not remain in Washington and soon traveled to other locations around the globe where other states became equally, if not more, interventionist. The assumption that current West Asian states are interventionists misses a crucial point in how these states have evolved over the course of their encounters with the enduring legacies of European colonial and American imperial adventurism. As an imperial politician, Powell retrieved and resuscitated the older colonial pedigree of European and American politics. When Saddam invaded Kuwait in August 1990, he thought Kuwait belonged to Iraq and the British had stolen it from Baghdad. There was a method to his madness. All the current borders of the West Asia region are the result of Sykes-Picot Agreement, which divided the Ottoman Empire into French and British spheres of influence. Powell's significance was in systematically re-articulating that colonial legacy in renewed imperial terms. I'm saddened by the death of Colin Powell without being tried for his crimes in Iraq, tweeted Muntazir al-Zaidi, Iraqi journalist who famously threw his shoes at then-President George W. Bush during a 2008 news conference in Baghdad. He added, "But I am sure that the court of God will be waiting for him." Powell might indeed have regretted his role in pre-predatory stages of the U.S. invasion and destruction of a sovereign nation. But such regrets do not really mean much. Powell was a key figure in recasting U.S. imperial logic towards a renewed commitment to global domination, and all its terrorizing consequences will remain his lasting legacy.
We get people.
U.S. aging nuclear program.
America's nuclear reactors are getting old. The oldest one opened in 1969, and the average age of all the reactors in the country is nearly 40 years old. And this age is considered too old for sensitive nuclear reactors. Most reactors which operated then are still active today.
It was the first step in a nuclear nightmare. As far as we know, at this hour, no worse than that. But a government official said that a breakdown in an atomic power plant in Pennsylvania today is probably the worst nuclear reactor accident to date. There was no apparent serious contamination of workers. But a nuclear safety group said that radiation inside the plant is at 8 times the deadly level, so strong that after passing through a 3-foot-thick concrete wall, it can be measured a mile away.
Hello and welcome to We the People, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll study aging nuclear plants and nuclear arsenals in the United States. Serious nuclear weapon incidents could also be just around the corner, and the Pentagon even has its own phrase for it, Broken Arrow. There have officially now been 33 nuclear arrows in the history of the United States so far, a number which could be far greater in reality. So what are the risks facing the nuclear sector, and should you be worried? Stay with us.
10 years ago, the Fukushima meltdown triggered a flurry of coverage, raising alarms within the U.S. about the decrepit reactors and how they may function in the face of a dysfunction in the reactors. Most notably, are they safe enough? More than ever before, the nuclear technology seems to be on the verge of slipping out of the U.S. government's control.
The catastrophic aspect of nuclear energy has been there from the get-go. Project Trinity potentially came close to a catastrophe in 1945 in the desert of New Mexico when a lightning storm occurred as a bomb was sitting on top of a tall steel tower. Our first guest today is John LaForge, co-director of NukeWatch. Welcome to the show, sir.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, John, what are some of the general dangers in having nukes this old, this outdated in America?
Well, they're very similar to the dangers of brand new reactors. They're all confronting living things with the very same dangers. They emit liquid and gaseous radioactivity on a regular basis. They're allowed to do this by permitting. Governments permit nuclear reactors to emit radioactive gases, krypton, xenon, and tritium, daily in order to regulate the temperature, the heat, and the pressure inside these units.
Thank you for joining us, Mr. John LaForge.
After World War II, the U.S. nuclear powers shifted mostly from nuclear warfare to the Cold War and ultimately towards energy production. President Eisenhower championed the cause and attended the opening of the first plant near Shipping Point, Pennsylvania.
Adding radioactive materials to the environment means that it ends up in the air, in the water, in the soil, ultimately in the food chain. Other dangers include, as you mentioned, with old reactors, you have the problem of parts wearing out, equipment being badly or intermittently or inadequately inspected and replaced if need be. And so the failure rate of parts and equipment in reactors increases as they age. The rate of failures goes up.
Many more power plants followed in the 1960s, although most of them were for experimental or training purposes and shut down within a few years' time. A slew of new plants, however, popped up in the late 1960s, as well as the 1970s and 1980s. We're now joined by nuclear scientist Behrad Nachai to get his perspective on this issue. Thank you for joining us, Doctor.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, if you could, please tell us, what are the impacts of outdated nuclear plants on an environment already reeling from the impacts of climate change?
Every problem that you have in nuclear power, or you have had with nuclear power, was the direct result of human error. If you follow the procedures and you follow what has been dictated to in the operation will go very smoothly. The nuclear power plant is built with many, many, many layers of safety and precaution. And because of that, it is very tolerant. Yet, the nuclear power plants that are operating today in the United States or in majority of the countries of the world are of the older generation, where we were still learning how to build, what to build, and how to operate.
Thank you, Dr. Nahe, for joining us on the program.
One of the most concerning aspects of the U.S. nuclear energy is the infrastructure, the wiring and computers and the launch control centers that still rely on 8-inch floppy disks. After all, creating complex technological systems is one thing and managing them another.
Now, with all the potential dangers that they carry, nuclear power plants supply about 20% of electricity for the U.S. power grid, although almost all of them were built decades back. Looking at the plants today makes one think of a vintage movie set. Do you think old reactors in the United States are doomed to end in failure? What scenarios could you imagine about the fate of those reactors?
Reactor meltdowns caused by earthquakes, tsunamis, other weather events like hurricanes, tornadoes, and quakes that threaten to shut off the cooling of these machines, resulting in overheating, meltdown, and then the broad and disastrous dispersal of highly radioactive materials, cesium-137, iodine-131, strontium-90, and other highly radioactive materials that cause so much cancer and other immune disorders.
Nuclear plants not only produce radioactive waste, but they are also vulnerable to a nuclear meltdown. A simple backup power failure could simply prevent water pumping used to cool the radioactive fuel rods, leading to a disaster. The fuel could heat up rapidly, and since these reactors operate at high pressure, there can be explosion from all this excess heat. The fuel itself is toxic and has to be stored underground for thousands of years. One can only extract about 4% of the energy out of the uranium, and the 96% that is left behind is waste.
The nuclear power plants that are operating today in the United States or in majority of the countries of the world are of the older generation, where we were still learning how to build, what to build, and how to operate. All these nuclear power plants are maintained, revitalized, changed continuously at every 2 years that they do refueling. So the plant that was built 30 years ago can get a license to run another 30 years.
Many experts and activists believe that Washington urgently needs to transform its regulatory framework, its culture, and its infrastructure related to nuclear operations. According to some estimates, the U.S. will spend about $188 billion over the 2021 to 2030 period to modernize nuclear weapons and delivery systems.
Since we cannot have a destructive testing of the nuclear power plant, we rely quite a bit on the operating experience for different parts of the plant, and IAEA should spearhead that to get into cooperation with the countries to have a safe nuclear power plant rather than try to politicize it.
The U.S. is set to spend some $175 billion toward modernizing its strategic nuclear triad and $13 billion to modernize its tactical nuclear weapons and delivery systems. So where do politicians, both liberals and conservatives, stand when it comes to closing the country's old nuclear power plants?
In the U.S., the pro-nuclear lobby is very, very rich and very powerful. So at the moment, the Congress is considering a bill that would add spend $50 billion to prop up and give financial support to old reactors instead of shutting them down. The other thing the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been doing is increasing the allowed lifespan of nuclear reactors. Every one in the United States was built to last 40 years. The NRC has uniformly and repeatedly given 20-year license extensions to reactor operators, so all over the country.
The U.S. old tech in the nuclear sector means that there is always the possibility for an unexpected accidental launching, firing, detonating, theft, or loss. So far, some 8 U.S. nuclear weapons have been lost and, shockingly, never recovered.
Inadequate maintenance and inspections. You have cutbacks because of economic problems with the cost of electricity and the reactor operators cutting back on inspections. You have corrosion of particular parts because of the corrosive materials inside these aging units that also weaken and degrade the parts. Ultimately, you have a possibility of loss of offsite power, as happened in Louisiana just recently as a result of a hurricane. Offsite power to the Waterford reactor in Louisiana was cut off, so that means, and this is after the power went out altogether, that electricity to recirculate the cooling water was halted.
The United States military misplaced at least 8 nuclear weapons permanently during the Cold War. The so-called strain nukes are said to have a combined explosive force 2,200 times the bomb the U.S. dropped on Hiroshima at the end of World War II.
Nuclear power programs in all these countries were initiated in order to provide plutonium for nuclear weapons. It was just a production source of a source of plutonium because the operating of a nuclear reactor using enriched uranium for fuel produces plutonium. The consequence of bombarding this uranium inside a reactor with neutrons creates plutonium inside the fuel rod. Now, the fuel rods are then removed and replaced with fresh ones after a time, and the used highly radioactive fuel rods can be treated chemically in these giant factories, chemically treated to extract the plutonium for weapons.
The U.S. has nearly 5,000 nuclear warheads with silos in North Dakota, Wyoming, and Montana. Now, this is while the country is short of skillful staff tasked with safeguarding the deadliest objects ever known to man. Dangerous mix of aging nuclear plants, industry cost-cutting, and reduced safety oversight could come at a great cost not only for Americans, but for all of humanity.
The problems with the environment have to do with people and the animals that live nearby. Many times, studies have repeatedly shown that the effects of these emissions on populations near reactors is an increase in cancer and leukemia, especially in young people.
The U.S. government needs to immediately address deficiencies in its oversight of nuclear reactor safety. At a June 2019 meeting, Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner Jeff Barron elicited from the staff that the number of sudden reactor shutdowns saw a nearly 20% increase and rose from 39 in 2017 to 46 in 2018.
Problems with older reactors, as I mentioned, tend to increase as they age. And so the impact on the environment is multiple, many-fold. It involves the, as I mentioned, the emission of radioactive gases and liquids, the problems of maintenance and upkeep, and the environment around these nuclear reactors ends up to be more heavily contaminated with radioactive materials than areas that don't have active or operating reactors in them.
The U.S. has too many nuclear weapons and facilities, but appears incapable of taking care of them properly. The U.S. narrowly avoided a catastrophic disaster when 2 Mark 39 hydrogen bombs were accidentally dropped over Goldsboro, North Carolina on January 23, 1961.
Politicians are indebted to the nuclear lobby, which Professor Judith Pasternak showed spends hundreds of millions of dollars every year. Her study was published in 2010. With her students, she found that the campaign, the companies that run reactors and the unions that support the workers in these plants spent $600 million lobbying between 2008 and 2 years from 2008 and 2009, they spent that much money.
In the 1961 incident, a Boeing B-52 Stratofortress carrying 2 3-4 megaton Mark 39 nuclear bombs broke up in midair, dropping its nuclear payload in the process near Goldsboro, North Carolina. Bombs miraculously failed to explode, but there are still those who defend the nuclear sector as a source of clean energy, arguing that more nuclear plants should be built in America.
Eventually, the hope is that the United States, because of the pollution and because of the climate changes, will come around and build new reactors. The mentality toward nuclear power in the United States has been changing quite a bit during the recent years. And now, whether you are the left or the right, conservative or liberal, more and more are realizing that a main response to the problem and challenges of climate is the nuclear power plant. And it's more and more coming back in the fold, and the people's attitude toward nuclear power plant are changing as well, and more are accepting.
The U.S. nuclear power industry is facing major challenges. The nuclear reactor fleet is getting older as the sector faces other cheaper and safer sources of energy from the sun, the wind, as well as gas. More intensive monitoring and preventive maintenance are therefore required for them to operate safely.
The way the industry calls it safe and reliable and carbon-free, all these things are preposterously wrong, and they're demonstrably, provably wrong. We know from disasters at Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima that none of these reactors are safe because of power outages, sea level rise, sea level surges during horrific storms, that these reactors aren't reliable. And of course, the mining and milling of uranium, the production of fuel, the building of reactors that involves hundreds of millions of tons of cement can't be considered carbon-free for a minute.
After all, aging-related failures could result in catastrophes that even U.S. adversaries such as Russia and China would not want. What is the relation between the U.S. nuclear sector and its rivalry with other superpowers such as Russia?
In the nuclear power plant technology, there is no rivalry based on technology. The rivalry only comes based on the, each country's financial interest. There are around 440 nuclear power plants operating around the world. About 93 of those are operating in the United States, about 56 in France, about 50 in China, about 38 in Russia, and about 33 in Japan, and goes down the list. It really amounts to, number one, technical capability of designing, building, and operating of the nuclear power plant, and two, whether financial part justifies. Russia has more has a lot of capability to build more, but because of the oil and gas that they have, they only build nuclear power plants when they need it.
Since old times, U.S. nuclear plants have been playing an important role in U.S. energy production, but they remain old, dangerous, and unsafe. There is not enough supervision on these plants, and many U.S. activists believe they're like taking time bombs, particularly with little inspection from nuclear watchdogs such as the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Inability to convey the information about the safety of the new nuclear power plant, other countries are far ahead of the United States. For example, China is ahead. France is thinking about the new reactors. United Kingdom is studying for the new reactors, and many other countries are actively studying and building new reactors.
Some of the plants in the U.S. are currently working beyond the license granted to them by the U.S. government itself. Who are the victims suffering from repercussions of old nuclear plants, and what role should nuclear watchdogs such as the IAEA play?
None of the older reactors, whether United States or any other country, cause any danger if the management follow the rules, follow the procedures for the operating of those plants. IAEA has two important, very important roles that often due to bending of due to political will, it does not perform exactly. Number one is to provide help to every country around the world that wants to use peaceful nuclear power plants. IAEA is not doing that effectively now. It should get more into that. Number two, it should provide a very bank of information about the operation of nuclear power plants around the world.
The U.S. ability to protect their facilities from terrorist attacks are also on decline, which could potentially expose them to rogue element, raising prospects of fuel meltdowns and releases of radiation to the environment. Only in the year 2018, more than 100 security violations were officially reported, a figure that sounds alarming to the public.
We also need to educate the lawmakers, parliamentarians, the politicians, and other government officials about these hazards. We need to work locally with city and municipal council members, especially in the areas where they have operating nuclear reactors or nuclear facilities like a reprocessing plant, for example, or a fuel fabrication site, or potential uranium mining. We need to connect with other movements as well, like campaigns against gun violence, climate change, campaigns for racial justice and indigenous people's rights, diversity in political life. All these groups or campaigns are relevant to challenging the status quo here. We need to disrupt also the dominant narrative about nuclear power.
Now, many experts highlight the increasingly significant necessity for an appropriate level of oversight, not just by American, but by international organizations such as the IAEA. Well, that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and you stay tuned next week when we come back with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Many of the Palestinian people displaced had sought refuge at facilities belonging to the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, which is the largest provider of aid in an area in which more than 70% of a population of some 2 million are refugees. But come summer, UNRWA chronically underfunded despite the renewal of aids, wanted their buildings back to run summer camps for children. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Hamza Abu El Tarabish, journalist. This article is published under the heading "Displaced by Israeli Regime Aggression, Families Angry at UN Response." Stay tuned for more. At the beginning of July, Nasreen Al-Vawr, 40, and her 15 children were informed they had to leave a school run by the UN in Jabalia refugee camp. Nasreen had been displaced during the Zionist regime's aggression on Gaza in May, when her house in Sudania area of northwestern Gaza suffered massive damage in one of the Israeli regime's bombing raids that month. There had been no possibility of reconstruction in the intervening period. The house remained as damaged as when she left it, and she was afraid to move back to a house that barely provided shelter for her husband, Ashraf, who is in poor health and had been chosen to stay in order to safeguard what was left of the family's home when it was bombed. But she was left with no choice. Today, she and Ashraf and their 15 children are sheltering in what remains of their home. Three walls are barely standing, and the roof is full of holes. And Nasreen is angry and upset at the UN for letting her family down. "My house is unlivable," Nasreen told the electronic Intifaza, adding, "I am afraid the walls might fall on us suddenly." Some 91,000 people in Gaza were displaced during the May bombardment. Most have since returned to their homes, but in late June, for more than 8,000 people with homes totally or partially destroyed, that simply was not possible. Nasreen and her family would be safer in alternative housing than in the remnants of their home, but have no other recourse. And with the Zionist regime sealing Gaza's borders to most building materials, reconstruction of the 2,000 homes that were so damaged as to be uninhabitable has been effectively prevented. Many of the people displaced had sought refuge at facilities belonging to the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, which is the largest provider of aid in an area in which more than 70% of a population of some 2 million are refugees. But come summer, UNRWA, chronically underfunded despite the renewal of USAID, wanted the buildings back to run summer camps for children. Along with Nasreen's family, another 22 families were made to leave the school in Jabalia, while 8 families had to vacate their places at an UNRWA school in the Beach refugee camp. Some received help with rent, but only according to UNRWA if their homes had been completely destroyed in May. Most had to seek shelter with relatives or return to the shells of their old homes. Still, all this might have passed as just another hardship of the extraordinarily tough living conditions in the besieged Gaza Strip, had it not been for some extremely ill-judged remarks made by one of the UNRWA senior officials that described the Israeli regime's strikes in Gaza in May as sophisticated. "I have the impression there is a huge sophistication in the way the Israeli regime military struck over the 11 days," Matthias Campbell, UNRWA's director of operations in Gaza, told an Israeli TV channel on May 23rd, not long after the attack had ended. He acknowledged that more than 60 children were killed, 19 of whom went to UNRWA schools. But somehow, that suggested to him that the precision was there, even as he called the deaths of civilians unacceptable and unbearable. Unsurprisingly, his remarks went down extremely poorly, especially in Gaza. UNRWA cuts cutting measures and job reductions over the past few years, coinciding with Scamo's appointment, have come to be seen as an attempt at undermining the rights of Palestinian refugees generally. Human rights organizations, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights and the Palestinian Human Rights Organizations Council issued a joint statement condemning his remarks, which they wrote completely ignored the crimes committed during the Israeli regime offensive. Angry voices online, both from Gaza and outside, denounced the UNRWA's director comments or called for his resignation, while protests were arranged in front of UNRWA's offices in Gaza that drew hundreds of people. UNRWA's director of operations in Gaza apologized for his comments, and the agency's commissioner general, Felipe Lazzarini, issued a written statement on this subject. But the damage was done. UNRWA recalled this person and his deputy to Al-Quds, where this person remains as acting chief of staff. Those remarks were the culmination of a series of missteps by Skemel that left both his personal credibility and that of UNRWA at a low ebb in Gaza. The director of UNRWA took up his position in 2017, a year before the Trump administration cut U.S. funding to the agency. His arrival, however, soon coincided with the slashing of UNRWA's budget. It became hugely unpopular when the agency revealed plans for hundreds of job reductions in 2018 following Trump's cruel cuts. Then UNRWA announced it would reform its food aid system, sparking fears that tens of thousands would sink deeper into poverty. And finally, the agency was woefully underprepared in May when it was suddenly faced with tens of thousands of people displaced by the Israeli regime's assault. Indeed, it was not only underprepared. For a while, UNRWA staffers actively tried to prevent the desperate displaced from entering the agency premises. Nasreena and her children were among their number after surviving a close call. They had been expecting it. Every night of the last aggression, I would place my children in different corners of the house, Nasreena told the electronic intifada. But on evening of May 14th, after bombing intensified, we gathered in one room. We were 19 people, including my husband, daughter-in-law, and her child. I believe that if we die together, no one would have to suffer mourning the others, unquote. It was a wise decision. Heavy Israeli regime bombing in the area on the night between May 14th and May 15th caused the house to nearly collapse, but no one inside was harmed. And that was when they decided to leave for the relative safety of an UNRWA facility. At the Jabalia school, however, Nasreen found hundreds of other desperate people and the gates locked. Muhammad Awadullah, 33, was there too, fleeing with his wife and four daughters from an intense bombardment near their home in the village of Om Nasr in northern Gaza. He was not going to let some closed gates stop him from reaching relative safety. When they refused to receive us, we had no choice but to break the gate, he told the electronic intifada, adding, we have no choice but to protect our children. An UNRWA spokesperson considered that the agency had been unprepared and was not at first willing to host people displaced in the assault. there were instructions from management that no one was allowed access to schools, but we changed these decisions within the first hour of people's displacement. Adnan Abu Hasna told the electronic Intifada. The escalation was sudden, and there had been no plan to receive displaced people. But UNRWA has always supported displaced people, unquote. Contingency plan or not, Nasreen now fears for her and her children's lives. Her house remains without secure walls or a full roof. And as the security situation in Gaza grows steadily worse, she worries about their safety. She has received no support from UNRWA, apart from some cans of fish, she told the electronic Intifada. Nothing has arrived to help her clothe her children or protect them through any kind of COVID-19 prevention. Today, the entire family shelters in just one room. It's a desperate situation with no end in sight. Abu Hasna considered that not enough was done at the beginning, but he insisted agency had provided psychological support in part through the summer camps that saw people like Nasreen forced out of schools in July to tens of thousands of children across Gaza. UNRWA is also providing some financial assistance, he said. For thousands of people who remain displaced, such words ring hollow. The behavior of officials like Iskmel has left Palestinians in Gaza deeply suspicious of the agency and its motives.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Afghanistan has welcomed the recent remarks by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who called for greater unity between Sunnis and Shias. This according to a tweet by a spokesman of the political office of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, Muhammad Naeem Wardak. He further said the Taliban are aware of the nation's enemies' scheme and work for tightening brotherhood among Afghan people.
The U.S. has always been trying to deepen the schism between Muslim sects both after the invasion and after the withdrawal. They don't stop their conspiracy, but the Islamic Emirate is aware of it and will never let the enemies of Islam reach their goals. However, they target Shias, but in fact, they are against all of us.
Afghan people have also welcomed Iran's leader's remarks. In a conference titled Islamic Unity Week and the Responsibility of People in the Afghan capital on Tuesday, the participants said Islamic unity should be part of culture in Muslim world.
Prominent Islamic scholar and the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, in a very critical point of time came and named this week as Islamic Unity Week, so that all Muslims keep their unity and brotherhood. We all have the same God, Prophet, and Qibla. Then let's benefit from these mutual values for our unity and make it a culture.
Addressing the 55th International Islamic Unity Conference in the Iranian capital, Iran's leader touched on the U.S. campaign to stoke sedition among Islamic countries with the help of its proxies. He said the recent unfortunate and distressing explosions at mosques targeting Muslim worshippers in Afghanistan are among such incidents that were carried out by Daesh. Earlier this month, Daesh terrorist group conducted two deadly attacks against Shia community in Afghanistan. Following the attacks, Muslim leaders noted that such incidents are meant to divide Muslims in the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's latest unemployment data showed a small improvement, but unemployment remains nearly 8%, at least officially. 5.9 million people remain unemployed, which is just just a fraction less than the all-time high of 6.3 million in 2017. Back in September 2008, the total jobless numbered just 4.5 million. That means French unemployment has risen over 30% since the start of the Great Recession. With re-election just 6 months away, many say that Macron is running out of time to devote resources to the jobless or to devise a new system of accounting. Macron campaigned on a promise to bring unemployment under 7%.
His effort or his promise to increase employment by changing labor laws that would make France more attractive to foreign investors just hasn't worked. This idea of bringing in migrants for cheap labor to keep wages down is a real issue. So it's a big problem for Macron.
Under Macron's predecessor, François Hollande, the jobless rate increased 44 out of 46 months at one point. To change that, Hollande controversially started excluding part-time underemployed workers from the official count. Macron went one better and declared that just looking for work once in the past month no longer makes someone unemployed. Macron also began revealing jobless data only once every 3 months to avoid media discussion of the unpopular issue.
We have to really distinguish between what the official unemployment rate is and what the unofficial unemployment rate is. And if we take what the potential workforce is, it's much, much higher. And it's really amazing because the service sectors, like restaurants and bars and stores and stuff, can't find people to fill positions. And the reason is they don't pay enough.
For years, many French economists have said that the official unemployment rate is undercounted by a third, which would put the real unemployment rate at well over 20%. The Macron era had been one of constant economic unrest, but the coronavirus pause seems to have ended, with protests recently increasing in number and intensity. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
President of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashaat, has sent a stern message to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, slamming the world body's inaction regarding Saudi Arabia's bloody war on Yemen.
Unfortunately, Saudi money has weakened the role of the United Nations in Yemen and has changed the world body's political position. The United Nations' primary concern should be the humanitarian situation in Yemen, but it has failed to consider that.
In the message sent to Antonio Guterres on United Nations Day, Mashaat called on the UN to stop manipulating the facts in Yemen for political ends. He said the world body has effectively covered up for Saudis during 7 years of war under blockade. He added that the UN failure to renew the mandate of the Human Rights Council's group of eminent experts is yet another proof of how Saudis are bribing their way through the world body.
It was not so much a message of congratulation as it was a message of blame for the UN's negative role regarding what the Yemeni people have been subjected to over the past 7 years. It's a clear message that the UN must play its role and that the international community has failed morally in Yemen. We are ready to support the continued work of the United Nations and its humanitarian organizations and facilitate their operations inside Yemen, but on the condition that the United Nations protects the Yemeni people and stops Saudi violations.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people, including women and children, and has pushed the country.